Welcome to The Bitter Witness.
Don't be scared.
Hello. Welcome back. I'm Rebecca. I'm your host from The Witness Stand. How was your week? I hope you're staying well. I've managed to switch podcast distributors this week, and I think the podcast is now up on Apple. That was quite a challenge, I must say. So now, The Bitter Witness should be available wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoy the show, please stop by our Patreon page and become an Eyewitness member. For a few cents a day, you will have access to exclusive content. Sometimes it will be shorter true crime cases, and sometimes I may dive deeper into some of the motivational or theoretical issues behind the crimes that we discuss on the show. The dogs are asleep behind me. Miley is snoring louder than a chainsaw slicing through a log. So grab a cup of tea, sit back and relax while I tell you the case of Paul and Charlene Runge. As usual, trigger warnings. This was a brutal, horrific, violent crime. As always, I want to give the victims in this crime top billing. Stacy, Janetta, Amela, Yolanda, Jessica, Dorothy, Casimira, as well as all your family members, I acknowledge you and I send my love to you wherever you may be. We're going to start around January of 1995. 25-year-old Stacy Froebel had had a tough life. She hadn't finished high school, and she had had trouble holding a job for very long. Her best friend, Susan Blanchard, stated in an interview that Stacy was a good person who went through hell and back in her life. She picked up waitressing jobs and gas station attendant positions to make ends meet. In Florida, in 1989, her first husband, 21-year-old Michael McDonald, had gotten drunk and punched a very pregnant Stacy in the stomach. He was arrested for domestic violence, but 15 minutes after he was put in a holding cell, he hung himself with his shirt. Their son, Daniel, was born about a month later. Stacy never believed that Michael's death was a suicide. After his death, she had a really rough time in her life and eventually gave custody of Daniel to her mother, Susan, until Stacy could get back on her feet. 24-year-old Jeff Froebel was Stacy's second husband, and their marriage was anything but wonderful. Neighbors of the couple stated that the couple often fought, and many times Stacy would be seen leaving the house after a screaming match between the couple. In late 1994, her marriage to Jeff was on the rocks, and Stacy was juggling a shitty marriage, a boyfriend, trying to get her life on track to get her 6-year-old son back, and looking for work. On September 3rd, 1994, Stacy was charged with drunken disorderly conduct after she was arrested in the parking lot of a shopping mall. People had called to complain after Stacy had started screaming in the middle of the parking lot. I couldn't find anything stating how the relationship was between Stacy and her boyfriend at that time, but needless to say, Stacy had a lot on her mind come January 3rd of 1995. She was in a spiral of issues. On January 3rd, 1995, Stacy was at the apartment of a friend for a little get-together with some other friends. Around midnight, she tried to call her boyfriend, but her boyfriend's mother answered the phone and told Stacy that he was sleeping and no, she wouldn't wake him up. Then she tried to call her husband, Jeff, but he didn't answer either. At approximately 12:45 a.m., Stacy bundled up and headed out of her friend's Streamwood apartment. Streamwood was and still is a smaller town about 35 miles or 56 kilometers west of Chicago. Stacy drove away from her friend's house early in the morning and was never seen again. When Stacy didn't come home, Jeff called the police on January 5th, 1995 and reported his wife as missing. The police began the investigation by interviewing the friend who owned the apartment where Stacy was last seen. The friend, Charlene, told police that she had gone to bed early that night. The friend's husband, Paul, informed police that Stacy had left in the middle of the night. The police were suspicious of the husband, Paul, but with no evidence against him and no sign of Stacy, they had to let it go. On February 10, 1995, police found Stacy's car parked in the parking lot of an apartment complex in Hanover Park, which was about a mile from the apartment of Paul and Charlene, where Stacy was last seen. Both the keys to the car and Stacy's purse were not inside the car. On January 16, 1995, a German Shepherd named Friendly came trotting into his backyard, just north of the Wisconsin-Illinois border, with a treasure for his owners, a severed partial human leg. His owners called police and a search began. However, no other body parts were found. A few days later, Friendly came home again with another severed leg. This time, the police conducted a larger, more intensive search. They brought in cadaver dogs and ground-penetrating radar, but again, nothing was found. So the police decided to take a GPS tracker and put it on Friendly's collar to see where the dog went, hoping he would lead them to the rest of the remains. But sadly, Friendly only wanted to play with the law enforcement officers who were following him on foot. Okay, if you're going to be smart enough to put a GPS tracking device on the collar of a dog who keeps bringing home body parts, then why would you follow close enough for the dog to see you? Now, I know this was the 90s, but even then, the GPS should have been good enough for the authorities to stay back and let the dog go where it wanted to go. I mean, come on, people. On March 21st, 1995, the police conducted one more search of the heavily wooded area surrounding Friendly's home. They brought in cadaver dogs and all the accoutrement needed. They also had a helicopter do a flyover with heat radar and took pictures of the landscape. After about 2 hours, Hawthorne, a cadaver dog, found part of a human skull within a dense swamp that was relatively close to the approximate area where the legs were found. On March 25, 1995, a right hand was discovered approximately 6 miles north from where the legs and skull were found. And on April 22, 1995, a left foot was found in a field approximately 400 yards from where the hand was found. Initially, the police believed the body parts to be from another missing girl, not Stacy, or perhaps even a sick medical school prank. But eventually, after DNA testing, it was revealed that the body parts belonged to Stacy. The husband of Stacy's friend, Paul Runge, became the main suspect in Stacy's murder as he was the last one to see her. But with no evidence, there was nothing the police could do. Now we're jumping up to July 11th, 1995. Sisters Janetta, 22, and Amela, 20, Pasenbovich, had moved to the United States in February of 1995 from war-ravaged Bosnia. Janetta and Amela's parents had sent the girls to live with their uncle so that they would be safe. The girls found jobs in a factory and were working hard, but shortly after moving in with their uncle, the girls started feeling suppressed. He was a little overprotective of the girls, and he still believed in the old world ways. They were in America. There was no war outside their door, and they were young and beautiful, and for the first time in their lives, they had freedom. They wanted to live the American dream. So the girls pooled their money and found an apartment and moved out of their uncle's house. This would allow the two excited sisters to start using some of that much-cherished freedom, start going out, making friends, maybe meet a boy, and just enjoying life. Shortly after the girls moved into their own apartment, they were laid off from the factory where they worked. They applied for unemployment and began looking for work. A friend of the girls gave them a ride to a mall where the sisters said they were going to fill out applications for jobs. They were never seen again. After 12 days of not hearing from them or seeing them, their uncle called the police. Police attended the girls' apartment, but nothing was out of place. The only thing that was weird was that they had a cat and the cat was missing. The police thought maybe that the girls had gone away and taken the cat with them. But the more investigating the police did, the more it seemed like there was more to the case than just the two sisters going on a vacation and taking their cat. Every friend that the police spoke to insisted that the girls would talk to friends every day, and there was no way they would go this long without reaching out to someone. Their parents were beside themselves. The girls would check in with their parents every week without fail. The police were certain now that something horrible had happened to Janetta and Amela. The police contacted the FBI. Agent Brian Bean was sent to look at the case. He realized that Stacy Froebel's car was found in an apartment building parking lot about a mile from Janetta and Amela's apartment. Detective Bean knew that the two cases had to be connected. The FBI realized that they might have a serial killer on the loose, and they needed to find him fast. Gertz and Bean singled out two co-workers of the girls that could possibly be involved in their disappearance. One turned out to just be a really good friend, and the other suspect was a boyfriend of one of the girls. Both of the men agreed to take polygraphs, and both of them passed, and they were cleared from the investigation. I know that polygraphs are not reliable and they're not admissible in court, but I believe that they still play a role in police investigations. One, because usually a law enforcement officer can get a feel or a read, if you will, on the suspect. If they happen to fail the polygraph test, that gives the officer something to work on or look into further. As well, if they refuse to take the polygraph test, why? Because they have something to hide, maybe? Finally, the FBI seemed to get a break in the case. While interviewing a former co-worker of the girls, they found out that the sisters had run into this girl while they were down at the unemployment office. That co-worker told the girls about a man who had a wife who owned a cleaning company, and they were looking for workers. The co-worker gave the girls the phone number, and then the co-worker gave the man the girl's phone number, just to really make sure that the girls and the cleaning company were able to get in touch with one another. The co-worker that told the girls about the cleaning company told the FBI that the cleaning company was owned by a couple named Paul and Charlene Rungay. The detectives found Paul and Charlene Rungay and asked them about the cleaning company and the two sisters, but the couple stated that they didn't own a cleaning business. Paul, the husband, told the agents that his wife used to clean houses, but they never actually owned a company. And both Paul and Charlene said they had never heard of Janetta or Amela before. The FBI were a little suspicious, but there was no evidence, and the couple seemed above board and said they didn't own a cleaning company. The FBI found out that Paul Rungay was a suspect in the case of Stacy Froebel. That increased their suspicion, but there was no proof that he'd done anything to the sisters. The FBI kept an eye on Rungay and continued working the disappearance of Janetta and Amela. But now, more than a year goes by, and there were no breaks in the case. Finally, the FBI ran a background check on Rungay and discovered that he was on parole for the rape and assault of a 14-year-old girl in 1987. In 1987, Rungay brutally raped and assaulted a 14-year-old girl. The girl, thankfully, managed to escape Rungay and was saved by neighbors. Detective Capitelli stated in one documentary that the attack on this young girl was the most horrible attack that any person could imagine. Capitelli stated that Rungay tortured the girl for hours before she was able to escape. Rungay was sentenced to 14 years. But he only served 7. Rungay had been paroled in 1994, just 1 year before Janetta and Amela disappeared. Now we're moving up to March 1996. With all this new information concerning Rungay, the FBI took what they had to a judge trying to get an arrest warrant for him, but they were denied. They were told that all they really had was circumstantial evidence, but they did have enough for a search warrant, but only for his car, since that is what Rungay would have had to use to dispose of the victims. When the FBI searches Rungay's car, they find a small pool of blood. But because of the technology at that time, there wasn't enough for them to analyze for DNA, so they weren't able to get an arrest warrant. All they could do was put Rungay and his wife under periodic surveillance. For the next several months, they follow Rungay and his wife. They were trying to determine what the couple's routines were, and they also wanted to make sure there were no more victims. But Rungay spots the surveillance team almost as soon as they begin watching him, and he would wave and acknowledge the team when he was putting out the garbage or walking into the shoe store where he worked. Runge and Charlene were having fun playing with the authorities. For example, one day, the couple got into their car. Charlene was driving, and she was driving like a bat out of hell, and she beelined straight for the airport. Once they reached the airport, Charlene slowed down and Runge jumped out of the vehicle with a suitcase and bolted into the airport. The surveillance team thought that Runge was trying to flee the country, so they gave chase through the airport. When the FBI managed to grab Runge, they opened up the suitcase he was carrying and there was nothing but towels inside. Runge started laughing and as he was walking away, he stated, "You guys got nothing on me." And then he walked out of the airport, got back into the car with Charlene, who was waiting outside for him, and the couple drove home. The couple taunted the FBI constantly throughout the surveillance period. Whenever either one of them were on the phone, they would state things like, "We know you're listening to us. How's the surveillance going today, guys?" The two of them were just toying with the authorities, and Runge and Charlene were loving every minute watching the FBI running around in circles like rats in a cage. Runge and Charlene both thought that they were smarter than the FBI. So the FBI decided to try something new. They sent an undercover agent into the shoe store where Runge worked. She started to flirt with him while he was helping her try on shoes. The whole goal of this was to try and have the female agent get Runge to talk about things that he had done. But Runge makes the agent right away and has someone else working in the store take care of her. Every time that the FBI tried to get Runge, he always seemed to be one step ahead of them. The FBI was sure he was the killer and they needed to get him off the streets. But there was no evidence linking him to any of the murders. The FBI kept Runge and Charlene under surveillance for a long time. They even went so far as to grab their garbage and sift through it. The FBI would stop the garbage truck around the corner as soon as it picked up the Runge's garbage and take the bags back to the lab to sift through it. But still, there was nothing linking Runge to the disappearance of the sisters or the murder of Stacy. In January of 1997, firefighters are called to the Chicago home of Dorota Zubek, also known as Dorothy. Once the firefighters got into the house, they found the body of Dorothy. Dorothy had a 5-year-old daughter, but luckily, Dorothy's daughter was away for the night and wasn't in the home for the fire. At first, the police think that Dorothy's death is just a horribly tragic accident. But then, the medical examiner sends his report, and in it, it states that Dorothy died from suffocation. When the police see that, they knew that it wasn't an accidental fire or death. The medical examiner found that Dorothy had ligature marks on her wrists, and there were bruises on her face. They looked as though she had been pushed down hard, and she had been sexually assaulted and strangled before she was burned. Whoever did this to her redressed her and poured accelerant all over her and lit her and the house on fire. The Chicago police started investigating Dorothy's death, but because they initially thought that Dorothy's death was the result of a fire and that it was an accident, they didn't collect enough or any forensic evidence from the scene. This left the police with little to no evidence to work with. I cannot believe that they didn't do a complete forensic workup even in the 90s. I mean, come on. Where were they? Mayberry RFD? The Chicago police interview a friend of Dorothy's. The friend told the police that Dorothy was trying to sell her home without a real estate agent. She also told the police that Dorothy had an appointment that day to show the property. When the prospective buyer showed up, Dorothy started speaking Polish to her friend on the phone. That was their native language. Dorothy told her friend that the prospective buyer was making her uncomfortable. He was supposed to be bringing his wife, and now he's here all alone. And Dorothy said he was creepy. Dorothy's friend offered to call 911, but Dorothy said no. Just call me back in 5 minutes. I'm sure it will all be fine. The friend called back in 5 minutes. There was no answer at Dorothy's house. So the friend called 911 and asked them to check on Dorothy. The police dispatched a unit to Dorothy's house, but at the exact time that the police were heading to Dorothy's house, The fire department was also heading there because a neighbor saw that Dorothy's house was on fire. February 3, 1997. Firefighters were called to a Chicago apartment. Once inside, they found the bodies of Yolanda Gutierrez and her daughter Jessica. People described Yolanda Gutierrez as a wonderful single mother who was dedicated to her daughter Jessica. It was just the two of them, and they had a wonderful bond. Jessica was a beautiful little girl, and people described her as a little chatterbox, and she was just an all-around wonderful little kid. Right away, the police knew this wasn't an accidental fire. They knew that the fire had been set to cover up the murders of Yolanda and Jessica. They were both tied on the same bed, and both their throats had been slit. The medical examiner stated in their report that both Yolanda and Jessica had been sexually assaulted, and accelerant had been poured over both of them prior to the fire being started. The police stated that there were some similarities between this horrific double murder and Dorothy's murder just a month before, but the Chicago police didn't think that the two were connected. The police stated in an interview that in many cases, perpetrators will start a fire to try and cover their crimes. So, to the Chicago police, it wasn't an obvious connection right away. They also stated that there wasn't any obvious similarities in victimology or pattern that would make them think that Dorothy's murder was connected to the murders of Yolanda and Jessica. The medical examiner was able to collect DNA from Jessica's body, and they compared that to DNA of all of Yolanda's male friends and acquaintances, but none of them matched the DNA found on little Jessica. And so the Chicago police had no suspect for these horrible murders. March 14, 1997. Kazmira Paruk was born in Poland on March 4, 1954. Kazmira had just finished going through a divorce and desperately wanted to sell her condo and return to her family in Poland. Chicago firefighters were called to a fire at Kazmira's condo. Once the fire was out, the firefighters found Kazmira's body on the floor of her bathroom. They knew right away it was a murder. Kazmira's body had blunt force trauma to her head and many bruises and scratches. This indicated that she fought hard against whoever had done this to her. With Kazmira's murder, the Chicago police finally see the pattern between the four murders and start to think that maybe they had a serial killer on the loose. Meanwhile, the FBI task force back in Hanover Park think that they have their own serial killer. Both agencies are working on their own case and don't know about the others. May 1997. After a year, the FBI finally get the piece of evidence they were waiting for. While sifting through the Runge's garbage, they find the piece of paper that Janetta and Amela's co-worker had given Charlene with their telephone number, their names, and part of their address on it. The piece of paper also states something about cleaning houses. The FBI now have the evidence that Runge and Charlene were lying when they said they didn't know anything about the sisters and that they knew nothing about having a cleaning business. The FBI flew the piece of paper back to Washington and found Charlene's fingerprints on the paper, which not only tied Charlene to the disappearance of Janetta and Amela, but also tied Runge to it as well. But when the FBI goes to a judge to get an arrest warrant, they're told that all they have with the fingerprint and the paper is great circumstantial evidence, but not enough for their arrest warrant. But they were able to get a search warrant for the Runge's house. Inside the Runge's house, they find a lot of weapons. They find a crossbow and a number of knives. The FBI describes the knives as Rambo knives or survival knives. The FBI confiscates all the weapons they found and sends them to the lab to see if there's any evidence on anything. But again, there's no evidence on any of the weapons from the Runge's home. The FBI decide that they are going to switch tactics again. This time, they approach Charlene and try and get her to cooperate with them to turn on her husband. But she basically tells them to go pound salt. The FBI knows that they need to get Runge off the streets, but they still don't have enough evidence to arrest him. But then they realize that the weapons they found inside the Rungay home is a violation of the parole that he's on for the 1987 rape and assault on the 14-year-old girl. FBI agent Brian Bean took the report from the house search right to Rungay's parole officer and the prison review board, hoping that it would be enough to put Rungay back in prison and off the streets. It worked, and they were finally given the green light to arrest Rungay. Now that they had Rungay in jail, they started putting more pressure on Charlene, hoping that because her husband was in jail, she would start to cooperate with them and give them the evidence they need to keep Rungay off the streets forever. Because Charlene's fingerprints had been found on the piece of paper with Janetta and Amela's phone number and address on it, she was implicated in their disappearance. So she had her lawyer contact the FBI, and she agreed to cooperate with them. But she made a deal. She would tell the FBI everything in exchange for immunity. And they agreed. Can you say deal with the devil? After you hear what Paul and Charlene admit to in this case, and I don't believe for a second that they told the authorities everything that Charlene actually did, you will agree that this woman was just as guilty of these murders as Rungay himself. Charlene tells the FBI that she picked up the sisters and took them to the Rungay's home, that the girls entered the house, but that Charlene stayed outside and smoked a cigarette. Charlene told the FBI that after a few minutes, one of the two sisters came running out of the front door screaming, but that Paul came out and caught her on the lawn. Charlene stated that Paul grabbed her by her hair and started dragging her back towards the house, but that the girl continued to try and fight him and kept screaming. So Paul slammed her head against the front step of the house over and over again until she was unconscious. Charlene told the FBI that once the girl was unconscious, Paul picked her up and carried her back inside the house. At that point, Charlene stated that she got back into her car and left. Charlene told the FBI that when she finally came back to the house later that night, she saw a nightmare sight inside it. She said she went down to the basement and there was a line of black garbage bags on the floor, and she knew that Paul had murdered and dismembered the two sisters. Charlene told the FBI that Paul loaded the bags into the car that night and went out and disposed of them in a number of dumpsters around the area. Okay. Number one, I believe that Charlene picked up the girls and took them to hers and Rungay's home with the intent for murder and sexual assault. Two, I don't believe that Charlene stood outside and smoked a cigarette. Why would those girls just walk into someone's house if the person who owns the house wasn't leading them inside? The girls didn't know about Paul. He was lying in wait inside the house. I don't think so. Charlene walked them inside that house, and she literally delivered them to her husband. Three, I don't believe that Charlene left that house and came back conveniently once the girls were sexually assaulted, murdered, and dismembered. That just seems a little too easy. Rungay was a sexual sadist. Sadism is based on sexual pleasure gained from inflicting pain and torture on someone else, having the power to inflict that pain. And although Rungay's way of achieving his sexual pleasure was seriously twisted, he was highly narcissistic as well. There is no way he would allow Charlene to leave the property while he was in the height of a sadistic episode. I believe that Charlene assisted Rungay in confining the girls or was actually included in the sexual assaults of Janetta and Amela. Meanwhile, while Charlene is speaking with the FBI and essentially securing the death penalty for her husband, the Chicago police decide to resubmit DNA samples that were collected in the murders of Yolanda and Jessica. Finally, they get a match from the database. Paul Rungay. When the DNA match to Rungay comes back, the FBI task force and the Chicago police force are both notified of the other's investigation, and finally, the FBI task force in Hanover Park and the Chicago police realize that they have both been chasing the same serial killer, and that killer was Paul Runge. They brought Runge into the interrogation room and asked him again if he had anything to do with any of the murders. Runge denied any involvement in everything. Then, Detective Capitelli walked into the interrogation room and showed Runge the report of the DNA and told him that either this was an extraterrestrial from a different universe or you. The odds of it being someone else was 1 in 32 trillion. When they told Runge those odds, he sat back and said, "You know I did it. You got me." Then he agreed to confess to the officers about the killings and what he was responsible for. But before he told them anything, he told them that he's scared that he's going to be killed in jail because he murdered a child. And he offers to tell them the names of his other victims if they agree to transfer him to another prison. They agreed. Paul Runge confessed to the rape and murder of 8 women. He said he snuck out of the house when he knew that the FBI wasn't watching him and went to Chicago to do his killing. When Runge is describing the murders that he committed to the authorities in that interrogation room, he is emotionless. It is like he is describing how he built a house. It's mechanical. There's no emotion, no expressions on his face. It was chilling. Now, first, I'm going to read to you what Runge said happened with Yolanda and Jessica's murders. On January 31st, 1997, Runge went to Yolanda's apartment to look at a Hooked on Phonics program. He told Yolanda that he would speak with his wife and get back to her. Runge returned on February 3rd, 1997 with Charlene. According to Runge, Charlene started yelling at Yolanda and grabbed her. Then Yolanda grabbed a knife to defend herself and told Charlene to leave her apartment. Runge says he took the knife from Yolanda and pushed her to the floor and told Charlene to bring him something to tie her up with. Runge stated that Charlene brought him duct tape and he bound both Yolanda and Jessica. Then he stated that he put both Yolanda and Jessica on the bed and sexually assaulted both of them. After he sexually assaulted Yolanda and Jessica, he cut Yolanda's throat in front of Jessica and then did the same to Jessica. Runge states that while he was sexually assaulting and murdering Yolanda and Jessica, Charlene was searching for some type of accelerant to start the fire with. She brought him a bottle of what he thought was turpentine. He doused the bed and the bodies of Yolanda and Jessica, lit a match, and he and Charlene walked out of the apartment and drove away. Now that was Runge's account of what happened to Yolanda and Jessica. Detective Capitelli told Runge that Charlene had told them a different version of the crime, one that didn't include Charlene as even being with Runge when he murdered them. Runge admitted to the police that Charlene had not been present when he had murdered any of the victims. Which I have said before, I don't believe that at all. I think that Runge used Charlene as his way inside the houses of these women, build enough trust with the women to at least open the door for him, sort of the way that Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka worked, at least for the initial meetings. We know that in Dorothy's case, Runge came back on his own, but still, if Charlene was able to abduct Janetta and Amela, she was capable of any of these crimes. At the very least, she knew what her husband was doing and what he had done, and she had the ability to go to the police and tell them, and if she had done that, maybe some of these victims would still be alive today. Yolanda, Jessica, Dorothy, and Kazmira's murders took place in Chicago. It was about 45 miles from where the FBI were working on Stacy, Janetta, and Amela's murders, out in the suburbs. The FBI stated in an interview that there was no way they could have connected the two crimes because they knew nothing about the sexual assaults and murders in the city. Both the FBI and Chicago police state that a second reason that hampered catching Runge was because Runge changed his modus operandi between crimes. They state that the murders of Stacy, Janetta, and Amela were crimes of opportunity that occurred on Runge's home turf, and that the other murders were crimes that he hunted by way of responding to ads of sale that each of the victims had posted. They most likely would never have connected them. During Runge's trial and sentencing in August of 2005, Dr. Michael Stone, a clinical psychologist who testified for the defense, stated that he assessed Runge for approximately 90 minutes. His diagnosis was that Runge was a sexual sadist with borderline antisocial personality disorder with narcissistic tendencies. Runge displayed minimal ability to control his behavior. Stone attempted to convince the court that at the time of the murders of Yolanda and Jessica, Runge was technically insane for the purposes of criminal responsibility, as Runge had been suffering from a loosening of his control over his obsession with sadism, and because of that, Runge was at risk to impulsively act out. But the judge didn't buy into that, neither did the jury. They found him guilty and sentenced Runge to death. Unfortunately, at least in this case, Illinois abolished the death penalty 5 years after Runge's sentence, and his sentence of death was commuted to life without parole. Runge is still serving his life sentence in the Pontiac Correction Center in Pontiac, Illinois. As for Charlene, she got away with her participation in the murders of all of these women. There is no information on her out there. I couldn't even find an old picture of her. I hope she has changed her ways, and I hope that she has gotten some kind of therapy. But my hopes don't make her any less guilty for her roles in these horrific crimes. I've been doing some research on sexual sadistic homicides, and I found that there is not a lot of research on the topic in general. However, the research that I did find was actually quite recent, as of 2022. The thing that makes Runge a unique offender is that his victimology was all over the map. He included various ages in his victims, including Jessica, who was only 10. And according to researchers, there is a large difference between offenders in the sexually sadistic category who kill children and adults. The whole point of a sexually sadistic murder is to gain sexual arousal and sexual satisfaction while inflicting pain on the victim. However, the characteristics of the offenders for each category differ. The offenders of sexually sadistic child murders have been described as stressed individuals who feel rejected and have low self-esteem. And from Runge's narcissism, we know that is not the case. As well, they are more likely to make contact with the child themselves prior to the murder and to commit the murder outdoors, which was not the case with Runge. He actually made contact with Yolanda, Jessica's mother, prior to the murder, and the murders took place inside their home. Now here's the interesting part. Sexually sadistic child murderers are more likely to commit the crime during the day, to use strangulation to kill the victim, and to dismember and hide the victim's body, as opposed to sexually sadistic murderers of adults who commit their murders, for the most part, at night, don't dismember or attempt to hide their victims' bodies. The fact that Runge was capable of altering his modus operandi, his victimology, and his disposal techniques indicates how highly mentally disturbed he is. Many offenders are organized as Runge was. However, they are unable to mentally commit their crimes unless the conditions are exactly as they need them to be. Being as adaptable as Runge was makes him extremely dangerous and even harder to apprehend. I'm going to read you some of the statements that family members of the victims made after the conviction and sentencing of Runge. Stacy's mother, Susan Eberle, stated, "It's been rough. Stacy's son Daniel first heard of his mother's murder while watching a TV newscast as he was getting ready to go to school one morning. But I wouldn't have survived it if I didn't have him. He keeps you going." Susan said that Daniel has memories of ice skating with Stacy, and he can recall the New Year's Eve he celebrated with his mom about 3 days before she disappeared. Susan said that Stacy bought a bottle of sparkling grape juice for her and Daniel to have as their champagne. He still has that bottle. Stacy's best friend stated she trusted everyone, and that's probably what got her killed. She also stated that Stacy did not have a drug problem. She had a love problem. She wanted to be loved and to love so badly, but she always ended up with really bad people. Maroz Zubak, Dorothy's brother, stated after the sentencing and conviction of Runge, "We tried to forget what really happened. The detectives said the case would never be closed, but they finally got it." Dorothy's daughter, Ashley, was 5 when her mother was killed. She was raised by Dorothy's parents after the murder. Sadly, she has very little recollection of her mother, but Dorothy's brother, Maroz, stated that the parents are trying their best to keep Dorothy's memory alive for Ashley. He stated, "She's got all her pictures in her room. She thinks her mother is an angel." Ramon Rivera, Yolanda's father and Jessica's grandfather, stated that he had mixed emotions. He stated, "I'm relieved because this is the final chapter, but it brings back memories, of course. Now we know who, but we're left to wonder why. Sadly, I don't think we'll ever truly know the answer to that question." This was a really horrible story. They were a killing combo, and unfortunately, due to a lack of evidence, which I believe was a direct result of lagging technology at the time, a little police incompetence, and a major lack of communication between authorities, these two pieces of shit were able to murder without consequence. And now, Runge is serving the sentence he deserves, but Charlene was free to restart her life, unlike the many victims she assisted in murdering. That was quite the story of Paul and Charlene Runge. Thank you for joining me. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to our Patreon page and become an eyewitness. You'll have access to the Bitter Bits once you subscribe. As well, please tell your friends to check out The Bitter Witness wherever you listen to podcasts. Please take care of yourselves and enjoy your day today. If you or someone you know is in danger or being harmed in any way, please reach out for help. There is help out there for you. This has been a Bitter Witness production.